You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, the House Committee investigating January 6th turns its focus to former President Donald Trump. How did months of misinformation play into the Capitol attack? Find out more today at 6 on 1A+. Now, the COVID-19 pandemic disrupted many aspects of life, including the job market. For quite a while now, people have been leaving jobs, in many cases, to move to another job in a tight labor market. And according to some federal data, many people who might otherwise have gone to college are opting to go into the workforce instead of pursuing higher education. Many employers are offering higher pay and better benefits, but will that last? We'll hear from an expert on what the future of labor might look like in the United States, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you in a better job than you were in before the pandemic started? Have you chosen not to work or to change the kind of job you do, change your career? Why have you decided to go into college, or maybe your kid? Or if you were on the fence about college, how did you weigh the decision of higher education or maybe taking a job that paid more than it did a couple years ago? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Enrique Lopez Lira is director of the Low Wage Work Program at the University of California, Berkeley Labor Center. He researches policies related to the racial and gender equity of working families. Enrique, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I referred to, you know, lots of people leaving their jobs. People call it the Great Resignation or the quitting. You say that doesn't really sum up what's happening very well. How do you read the number of people leaving their jobs and maybe just switching to another job?
Yeah, I believe the Great Resignation term is not quite adequate. I prefer the term that was coined by Professor Dubay, Great Reshuffling, because what we are seeing is that people are leaving their jobs, but they're going to pursue some of the better jobs out there right now, the better paying jobs. And so the numbers show a lot of people leaving, but also a lot of people being rehired potentially better paying, better quality jobs. And so it's more of a reshuffling than a resignation.
Your work focuses a lot on people at lower wage levels. What has this all meant for them, this tight labor market? Is it paying off significantly for people in those lower paying jobs?
Yeah, it's a great question. We definitely are seeing higher wage growth at the bottom of the wage distribution. And the pandemic really hit low-wage workers the hardest for many reasons, but one of them is that the shutdown of the economy particularly hurt leisure and hospitality industries and retail, and those tend to hire a larger proportion of low-wage workers. And so for us, we want to make sure that the recovery is helping those that were hurt the most. Now, wages did not grow very fast after the last recession, and it took a while for wages to start picking back up. And even after they picked up, it was only slightly compared to workers making much higher wages. So the higher wages we're seeing for those low wage workers today is very much welcome, because these workers have been struggling for so long to catch up to the rest of the workforce.
One of the things that prompted this conversation, we saw a piece in the New York Times saying, you know, a lot of people who might have been in the market for higher education, going to a community college or other, or maybe a four-year school, saying, you know, these jobs I can get now, they're paying pretty good. I'm going to put off or even skip a higher education. Is that something you've been watching for?
A little bit. It's true that in economics and in labor studies, we tend to focus more on the impact on employment from higher wages. And so there's not a lot as much robust research on what happens to what we call, you know, human capital accumulation, or what people do to gain skills when wages rise. And if you just think in pure economic theory terms, when the price of something goes up, people tend to do less of that. And so if you think of the price of college as the income you give up, then wages rising now means that the price of going to college has gone up. instead of just going to work. And so people are going to choose to work rather than go to college. However, like I said, you know, that's theory. And the question is, does the data bear that out? There was a study done recently last year, I believe, but it was looking at Canadian data. And what it found is that when wages went up, people tended to enroll in community college, probably because those colleges offer occupational training and licensing and those kind of vocational skills rather than university. But the folks who were enrolling primarily were adults, not so much, you know, the younger teenagers who are deciding, do I go to university or do I go to work after high school? What we're seeing, what was shown in that study was it was older workers. Now, if you look at low wage work, it kind of makes sense because people tend to think of low wage work as like young people working in fast food. But the reality is that most low wage work is done by adults. And so adults probably would want to take advantage of higher paying occupations, but they feel like they need to get an additional licensing. But if you're an older worker, it doesn't necessarily mean that you're a full-time student. You might just be going to community college and at night and still working in the daytime.
We are talking about the job market now and in the future. Enrique Lopez Lira is with us from the low-wage work program at the University of California, Berkeley Labor Center. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you changed jobs? Has your job changed since the pandemic started? Have you moved into something higher paying? Call 800-642-1234. If you're an employer, what are you seeing in this tight labor market? Can you hire people? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Let's go to a caller now. Brian is with us near Black River Falls. Hi, Brian.
Hi, good afternoon. Trucker Brian here.
What do you think, Brian?
Well, I think I'd love to see legislation in the United States of America where it says when a company or corporation makes X amount of dollars profit, they'll just turn around at the end of the year and give the employees a healthy bonus. Game over. Legislation does that. Now maybe get rid of the unions, and then they can, instead of paying union dues, now you can take your kids to a soccer game, buy them hockey gloves or ice cream. Why doesn't legislation kick in with something that mandatory an employer has to kick back to the employees a healthy bonus at the end of the year?
Brian, thanks for the call. Enrique, that reminds you see charts every now and then going from like the 70s and 80s, through the last few years showing, you know, productivity in the U.S. economy going up, oftentimes corporate profits going up, wages, especially at those lower levels, stagnating. Whether it's Brian's particular legislative idea or something else, do you see that as a problem?
Oh, definitely. And you're absolutely right about those charts. And however, one of the reasons for those charts is because of the demise of unions during that period. When union membership was at its highest, that's when you saw the higher wage growth in those lower wage occupations, and you actually had a robust and thriving middle class. And so I agree to the caller with the caller to an extent. There's a lot of talk about the higher wages today, but if you look at it, corporate profits are even higher and almost at record levels. And so there's a lot of talk about, you know, wages driving some of the price increases that we're seeing in the economy. But I would argue that corporate profits have a much bigger factor in that than wages. And so if you look at the public opinion today, unions have some of the highest public opinion since the 60s. And it's because people are finally realizing that a lot of the gains of that productivity have been accruing to the corporations and the executives running those corporations, and not to the workers who are actually providing the production that is reflected in those productivity gains.
Brian, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Joe joins us next in Madison. Joe, hi.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for having me. Yeah, I mean, in my personal situation, I've been very fortunate due to the COVID lockdown and, you know, the extra government stimulus. You know, I quit my career of 18 years of being a chef And I started my own business as a contractor. You know, there's a lot of low barriers to entry into it. And, you know, the economy, at least here in Madison, was doing really well. And we just hit our first year and been doing great. And, you know, hiring people that I've known my whole life. And, you know, we had a nice run there where for 6 months is like, yeah, you know, I'm paying everybody, you know, $20 to $30 an hour, depending on their skill level. I felt really happy that I was able to pay these guys so well. But, you know, now we see everything going up and it's just like, well, now it's just going to be par for the course again. But, yeah, you know, all in all, I've just been really lucky, and COVID actually helped me, you know, in the great resignation, if you will.
Joe, thanks a lot for sharing your story. Enrique, I know I talked to some people early in the COVID era, both when restaurants were closed and as they started to reopen, a sense that a lot of people might leave service type jobs like that, vulnerable to COVID. People not being treated very well, honestly, by customers when they returned. Do you think there are a lot of stories like Joe's out there?
Yeah, we definitely have seen a lot of anecdotal evidence similar to Joe's. You know, we forget that we're still in a pandemic, you know, we haven't officially declared the pandemic as concluded, and you know, it's great to see wages go up, but the quality of these jobs has not improved. A lot of these jobs still have very uncertain schedule for workers, which makes it very hard to plan with family and vacations and doctor visits. A lot of these jobs don't have healthcare benefits. A lot of these jobs don't have paid sick leave or retirement. And it's really hard for a lot of these workers to work from home to do these jobs. And so we do see in the data still some workers who are not back into the workforce because they're still afraid of their health, of the fact that we're still in a pandemic, and the jobs they've been doing don't offer the protections that they would like. So I think it's great if you can switch careers and improve your situation. But for many workers, that's just not a possibility.
Joe, thanks a lot for sharing your story. We're talking to Enrique Lopez Lira, director of the Low Wage Work Program at the University of California, Berkeley Labor Center. He's with us to talk about the current job market, a tight labor market, how that might change in the future for employees and employers. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. How has the pandemic economy affected you? Have you changed your job at some point? Have you had trouble hiring people? And did you change college plans based on the availability of jobs, you or maybe your potentially college-bound kid? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We continue our talk with Enrique Lopez Lira, director of the Low Wage Work Program at the University of California, Berkeley Labor Center, looking at the job market, a tight labor market now. A lot of people still apparently switching jobs and what the future could hold. And you can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions, your thoughts, maybe your stories. Are you an employer who's hiring right now? What are you seeing out there? Have you had to change things in your business to draw people in? Are you looking for a job from a position of not having a job at all or maybe looking for a switch? What are you seeing out there right now? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Enrique, you were just talking about, you know, jobs, some of the lower wage jobs maybe paying better now, but not seeing some of those fundamental changes you mentioned, predictable working hours, health benefits, sick days, that kind of thing. Do you see any kind of movement in that direction now, though?
Well, we're seeing a lot of workers, you know, voting with their feet, so to speak, by switching jobs. But we're also seeing a movement of workers trying to use this opportunity of a tight labor market to gain worker power and improve the conditions for themselves and their coworkers. So we've seen that in places that have unions where they've gone on strike, like in Kellogg's. But also seeing it in places that don't have unions where workers are starting to unionize or behave as if they were part of a union and collectively tried to bargain with their employers. And so we're seeing increase in unionization in places that didn't have unions before, like Starbucks, some of it in Amazon, but also seeing it in other places that, you know, they don't have a union, but they've threatened to walk out collectively to get their employers to improve the quality of those jobs. And so that we are seeing some of that.
And we've been focusing on what I think people might look at good news for workers, low unemployment rates, jobs generally seem to be available, wages going up in many cases. There are some downsides to the economy, of course, inflation, concerns about rising interest rates to combat inflation, worries about a recession. How much do you worry that some of the gains workers might be making will be fleeting if some of the bad news comes to the fore?
We want the wage gains to be real wage gains, meaning that they help workers once you account for inflation. But again, I would argue that a big part of the price rise is coming from corporate profits. And so I would like the policymakers to be careful that the policies that they enact to deal with inflation do not revert some of the gains for workers as well. I do want to say one other thing is that the pandemic exacerbated a lot of the problems that already existed prior to the pandemic. And so part of the tightness in the labor market we're seeing is from a decline in immigration starting in 2016 due to federal policies on immigration. But also we have an older workforce that's been getting older, and we haven't seen the rates of young workers to replenish those older workers. We saw a large exit of older workers during the pandemic. Some of them have come back now, presumably because of higher wages, but we're still seeing some older workers who are not gonna come back. And we're still seeing, once you adjust for the pre-pandemic trend and population growth, I believe there was an estimate from the Kansas City Federal Reserve that somewhere between 2 and 3 million workers are still missing from the workforce. And so I think the pandemic sped up some of the problems that we already had in our labor market. Again, lack of immigration and older workforce versus a younger workforce.
Are there policy changes, either at the federal level or things that states could do that you think would help especially these lower wage workers in a long-term and meaningful way?
Yes, I believe so. You know, if states or the federal government could increase the federal minimum wage, that would help at the federal level lift a lot of workers out of poverty and also help workers gain power. But at the state levels, we're seeing minimum wage increases in many places. But what would help also would be policies that allow workers to collectively bargain with workers, with employers, or to join unions or form unions, anything that would allow workers to improve their power that they haven't had in the recent past and allow them to gain the productivity increases that are a function of their work rather going to corporate bottom lines. Any of those policies would be very helpful for workers in the long term.
Before we run out of time, you focus in part in your research on racial and gender equity for working families. How have you seen the pandemic affect women and people of color maybe differently over the course of the pandemic?
Yeah, that's a great question. Yes, this downturn hit women particularly hard because of the impact of COVID on caretaking responsibilities. Another thing that the COVID showed was the crisis of care that we have in this country, and women tend to do most of the care, whether it was caring for children who were forced out of schools when the shutdown, or caring for elder relatives who their nursing home shut down, and so now they had to take care for these relatives. And so there's still many of these women out there out of the workforce who are still caring for folks. So women got hit pretty hard, but also minorities, Black and Latino workers and Asian workers were hit hard because of what's called occupational segregation, meaning that minorities tend to be overrepresented in industries like restaurants and bars and hotels that were particularly hit hard by the pandemic. And so we're seeing some of these groups rebound, but they're still trailing other groups, and they're still not quite to the trend before the pandemic.
We'll leave it there. Enrique, thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Enrique Lopez Lira, director of the Low Wage Work Program at the University of California, Berkeley Labor Center. He researches policies related to racial and gender equity of working families. He joined us today to look at the future of the job market and the current tight labor market, and a lot of open questions still as the pandemic goes on and affects the working world. Still time for you to share your story, by the way. If you changed your career, changed your job, left the labor market maybe earlier than planned, let us know. Email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Or you can always tweet us at Central Time WPR. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, more talk related to the economy. The stock market has been heading down lately with some big drops along the way, yesterday in particular. We'll look at the market downturn and what it means for the overall economy and for you. And a Milwaukee reading fan shares recommendations online. We'll get some great ideas for summer reads, and you could share yours too. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.
It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a bipartisan group of lawmakers in Congress have reached a deal to increase support for red flag laws, school safety, and mental health care. We'll talk to a Second Amendment and gun violence expert about the framework and what impact it could have on gun issues here in the United States. First, the new movie Top Gun Maverick is already the highest-grossing film of 2022 after just 3 weeks in theaters. With a strong opening weekend for the new Jurassic World movie as well, some people in the film industry think June could be the first month to hit $1 billion in box office sales since before the pandemic. People seem to be getting back out to the theaters, at least right now, and it's happening as some streaming platforms like Netflix are facing financial challenges. You could join in at 800-642-1234. When was the last time you went to the movie theater? Was it 3 years or 3 days ago? What did you see? Do you prefer going to see a movie on the big screen over streaming it at home? Or does it depend on the kind of movie? Are you still holding off on going back to theaters? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Eric Hoyt is the Call Family Professor of Media Production and a Professor of Film, Media, and Cultural Studies at UW-Madison. Eric, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob. It's a pleasure to be here.
Right, before we get into the movie business, you saw Top Gun Maverick. What did you think?
Oh, I loved it. I had a great time going to see Top Gun Maverick and going to see it at the movies. Seeing it on the Ultra screen over at the Marcus Point Theater on the west side, close to my house. great visuals, great sound. And they did a great job, I think, within the movie, finding an emotional center, kind of embedding like something of kind of a heist movie type plot. Like it's almost like a heist that they're trying to pull off with their F-18s. So I think it's an extremely well executed blockbuster. I had a great time.
Well, and the movie industry is trying to pull off a comeback after a couple of years where, you know, there were no movies at theaters, then very sort of limited attendance. Top Gun Maverick comes after Spider-Man No Way Home, The Batman. Now we've got Jurassic World. Is this a trend? Are we seeing people going back, at least for the blockbusters?
Yeah, I mean, I think the trend of making blockbusters based on pre-branded materials certainly goes back well before the pandemic. And all those movies you just brought up fit that pattern perfectly, right? Taking comic book franchises, other franchises like the Jurassic Park series that have been a hit, and the people are familiar with. And Top Gun Maverick itself had that pre-awareness going for it. You know, people remember and many love the original Top Gun. So, you know, I'm sure the industry is very happy with the grosses that this is making for them. I have no doubt they'll continue to make those kinds of franchise-oriented movies. I also hope, though, they take note of the success of Everything Everywhere All at Once, an independent film made by the Daniels, starring Michelle Yeoh and Stephanie Hsu, that has been a big hit, at least, you know, playing, not just playing actually in art theaters, playing in multiplexes. I checked the grosses on that, and it's now up to $82 million in U.S. box office. And I do want to call that out on the radio because I, like I said, really enjoyed going to see Top Gun, but I also think it's sad for our movie landscape if we only get the sequels and reboots and new iterations of the franchises. And so I hope that the people who greenlight movies can also pay attention to Everything Everywhere All at Once and take chances on telling those kinds of new stories with new casts.
Even pre-pandemic, as you say, these established franchises were a big deal. A lot hung on those blockbusters. Are we close to normal now compared with pre-pandemic for all the other stuff to the extent that people are going to see the non-blockbusters at a movie theater?
It's an interesting question. You know, I think the pandemic really accelerated a lot of things that were already happening in the industry. And there's a film scholar based at the University of Georgia, Kate Fortmuller, who wrote a book on pandemic Hollywood, where that was kind of one of her central claims and arguments. And I do think it makes a lot of sense to think about that. Again, thinking of the pandemic as an accelerant. So streaming was already on the rise before the pandemic. That turned toward placing big bets on the pre-established franchise brands. That was on the rise too. And during the pandemic, we saw the windows, in other words, the amount of time between movies playing in the theater and going on streaming, collapse in some cases to 0 days, going simultaneously, day and date. Warner Brothers famously and controversially did this for its films in 2021. I really appreciated it as a parent of young kids who were not vaccinated to be able to stay home and watch the new Matrix and Dune. But there is something very special about the theatrical experience. Those movies did play theatrically, but I think Warner Brothers, in hindsight, also feels like they left some money on the table. You know, you can make a tremendous amount of money very quickly if you can motivate people, you know, tens of millions of people to all go to movie theaters and pay $10 to $12 to see a movie. It's very difficult to try to raise that much revenue in such a quick period of time just by selling subscriptions. So the industry is clearly trying to have it both ways, to be able to have viable, successful streaming businesses and keep open a theatrical marketplace that gives people rich cinematic experiences and social experiences that we want when we leave the house. And so I think both will coexist. I think if there's a concern, it's what I brought up earlier, which is what space is left for new voices, for new types of stories to break through. And, you know, in some cases, I think we have to look beyond the United States for that. And so I'll give a shout out here to the Wisconsin Film Festival, which takes place in Madison every spring. And it's just a wonderful time and event to be able to take in movies made from around the world, including the United States, also watching old movies made decades ago. And these are all films that will not be at the multiplex, but that do merit our attention.
We're talking to UW-Madison film and media professor Eric Hoyt about the movie industry's bounce back, at least for now, at the box office, with some high-profile blockbusters getting people out to the theaters again. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been to a movie theater lately? Did you see a Top Gun Maverick or the new Jurassic World movie? Or are you planning to? Or one of the big superhero movies or something else? Or are you 100% streaming now when it comes to movies, new or old? Or somewhere in between? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Eric Hoyt, UW-Madison professor of film, media, and cultural studies, looking at the return of the movie blockbuster that people actually go to a theater to see, Jurassic World Dominion, one of them, Top Gun Maverick, and others. You can join in if you'd like at 800-642-1234. Want to hear your theater story. Are you going back to watch movies? What have you gone out to see lately? If so, are you staying home to watch movies? What are you watching there? Do you have particular kinds of movies that you gotta see, but only on the big screen? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Eric, you mentioned some big theaters or some big movie companies bringing their movies to streaming, you know, closer to the release date in theaters than they used to. Some convergence here. It sounds like Netflix, you know, when they produce original movies, may actually release some not just on their streaming platform, but in theaters. What are you watching for there?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a complicated landscape in that the exhibitors, movie theater owners, as we may understand, are quite defensive when it comes to streaming movies on the same day that they open. And so Netflix original movies have not played as widely in theaters, in part because the movie theater owners have said no, that if you want to open the Irishman, let's say, if you go back to that Scorsese movie or Roma, Netflix has made some really great movies over the years. Then the AMCs and Regals and the top chains will not play them. That's my understanding of how some of those dynamics have gone. But is there an appetite for seeing movies either at streaming or in the theater? Yes, of course. And, that's not brand new either. Growing up, probably many of us listening to the radio saw movies in the theaters and watched them on TV, sometimes late at night when they would broadcast, and then rented them on VHS and DVD and watched them there too. So all of these things can coexist, but it doesn't mean that there aren't conflicts and tensions between those different players within the industry over it.
We heard from Jessica on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Jessica says, "Everything Everywhere All at Once was fantastic. I loved how different it was compared to everything else that seems to have come out lately." Backing on what you were saying, Eric, some people do want that counter programming. This isn't an established franchise kind of movie.
Yes, right on, Jessica. It was such a breath of fresh air. Great action and visual effects, and centering an Asian American cast in a way that few other movies, especially that take the both dramatic and kind of action approach that it does do. So I'm with you, Jessica.
Thanks for that, Jessica. We'll go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Leo is with us in Milton. Leo, hi.
Hey there. I just wanted to comment, like, I'm a big fan of Star Wars, and I've seen that with that, like, series after COVID hit, a lot of, like, the releases have been more like the shows and less like standalone movies. And I thought that was just kind of an interesting way that that series has, like, adapted.
Interesting, Leo. Thanks a lot for that. Yeah, the Star Wars movie franchise, more and more TV show franchises coming out of it. Does this mean something, Eric?
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, I think that particular franchise, you're right, Leo, has its own very specific history. My understanding is Disney has been disappointed with the way that the movie franchise has played out over the last, you know, 5-6 years. And they've put far more attention, you're right, Leo, into those shows. The latest one is the Obi-Wan Kenobi show that's on Disney Plus. So if the movies were doing the kind of business that Disney's Marvel movies did, you know, like Avengers Endgame becoming one of the highest grossing movies of all time, then you would be seeing much more Star Wars in the multiplex. To me, it feels like Disney is kind of still trying to figure out what to do with theatrical movies from Star Wars. And they're you know, putting their foot on the gas full throttle for television, which is ironic, of course, because it all started with a movie in 1977.
Thanks a lot for that call, Leo, at 800-642-1234. Talking to Eric Hoyt, UW-Madison Professor of Film, Media, and Cultural Studies, talking about maybe the return of the blockbuster, some movies doing big business, people going to theaters to see them. We heard from David on the Ideas Network Facebook page, who says, haven't been to a movie theater in decades. And that's, I think, got to be a worry for movie theater owners. COVID even. Some people just moved away from the movie experience. Home entertainment systems getting better and better over the years. There's some people who are maybe out of reach for the theaters now.
Yeah, well, we want you back, David. you know, going to the movies in the summer with a bucket of popcorn and a cold drink is a great experience. But there's lots of things that compete for our time. And, you know, it's not just TV and streaming and video games. It's all kinds of other leisure time experiences when we even have the benefit of leisure. So there's a lot competing for our time. And the movie industry would love to have you back, David, and there's probably people sitting in a room right now trying to think about how to reach you and what it would take to make you come back.
Now, something I wonder a lot about, Eric, not being a filmmaker in any way, shape, or form myself, if I'm making a movie with the intention of people watching it on a big screen, does that make it a different movie than if I'm coming in thinking you're going to be watching this on your TV at home? Is that the same movie?
Oh, that's such an interesting question, Rob. I mean, I think most filmmakers do aspire to have their work seen, you know, as widely as possible, let's say. And some may also know, okay, well, this is my audience and the audience I really want to reach. From a stylistic standpoint, yeah, I could see how that would change your perspective and approach in terms of how you're framing things and even like composing a shot if you're thinking that someone might see it on a giant IMAX screen or you know, huge screen compared to an iPad. Most filmmakers today, though, I think know that they need to create works that can be experienced across a variety of different formats. And the theatrical experience can give us something that's, you know, very powerful that a smaller screen can't. And in some ways, I think that's not even just about the screen size. It's also about that feeling of kind of concentration and, you know, letting go of some things, not checking your email on your phone incessantly or pausing to go to the door or something like that. So I think that's also part of what a lot of people value with the theatrical experience.
In our last minute or so, Eric, are there particular movies coming to a theater near us that you are looking forward to?
Thanks for that question. I'm excited to see Nope. That's the new Jordan Peele horror movie that's coming out later this summer. I think that looks really good. And I'm also excited for the programming that's going to be starting up soon at the UW Cinematheque. Here on the UW-Madison campus, there's going to be a retrospective of films from the late director Peter Bogdanovich. There's going to be a Jackie Chan double feature. And there's going to be some great programming coming down the pike later this fall, too, from the Cinematheque. And I'll also just make a plug for seeing old movies at your local Cinematheque, your local movie theater. So I've already gotten my tickets to see Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan. 40th anniversary screening coming up around Labor Day.
Eric, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
Eric Hoyt is the Kahl Family Professor of Media Production and Professor of Film, Media, and Cultural Studies at UW-Madison. He joined us today to look at the box office success of some recent blockbusters like Top Gun Maverick and Jurassic World Dominion, what it all means for the film industry. Still time for you to share your thoughts on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Graduation season is in full swing across Wisconsin, and we asked graduates of all ages about their visions for the future. Today, we share the hopes of some elementary, middle, and high school grads.
My name is Adelia Luna. I am 14 years old, and I go to Toki Middle School, and I'm graduating 8th grade. I'm excited to be in a new learning environment because I just want to figure out what I'm into because I don't really know what I like to do yet. So I just want to go everywhere and see what I'm able to do. My hopes for the world is the world will be a lot happier, safer, and clean. It's very dirty. Racism still exists and it needs to be dealt with. And also climate change, women's rights. I feel like the world is already protesting about many things. So hopefully by the time I'm done with all the school I have, the world is a lot better than it is now.
My name is Junior Moreno, and I'm 22 years old. My education, it means a lot to me. I've been incarcerated for about 6 years. So before I released to the community, I really wanted to get it done. And even though I had all this time, I wanted to do something positive. As time has passed, I got older and I matured a lot, and I actually wanted to do something than to just sit around and go home and didn't accomplish anything. I could take my education to the next level and participate in some type of college courses when I do come home. As of right now, we only get school Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays, and a lot of times it'd be a lot of short staff, so we could barely even go to school. So sometimes we'll get it twice or once or none, so we just never know what to expect as far as school, and that'll make you really want to give up because you can't study and you gotta sit there in your room and just teach yourself. And it's really hard because I done tried to give up a lot of times, and Ms. Davis done talked to me a lot, and she just told me keep going and keep going, and because of her, I finished.
Hello, my name is Simone, and I'm 10 years old. I'm a part of the LGBTQ community. I am pansexual and non-binary. I am going to middle school next year. I'm quite known for my sketching skills. I'm best at drawing the human body. I'm not very good at drawing hands and feet and stuff like that, but I just put really long sleeves on them. I can draw faces, a little bit of hair, and a pretty good torso and a little bit of legs. I hope COVID will stop. And I hope world peace and global warming to end and not that much littering. Or robots will rule the world.
My name is Gordon Allen. I'm a 12th grader here at Madison East. I'm graduating sometime in early June, and I plan to attend Stanford University. When I was young, I wanted to be mayor, actually. Of course, right? Currently, though, I plan to work in finance for a while and then ultimately run for Congress. I found out I got into Stanford here at school. I was on my way to period 6 or 7, and I got the email notification. That first email said, I'll check the portal because you have an application update. So I logged in. You shouldn't do this in the middle of a hallway, but I did anyway. And it said, congratulations to you. You was a master of Stanford University with a Crespo scholarship. And like, you know, I just stopped there in the middle of the hallway and I was in shock. I mean, have you seen their acceptance rate? And then after that, I went to my seventh period teacher and told her about it. And then I just spent the rest of the day just telling as many people as I could. I do worry, like, what if I like California too much? I don't want to come back.
WPR congratulates all of the state's graduates. Tomorrow we'll hear from some of the state's college grads. You can read more about the people we spoke with at WPR.org. Coming up after the news, a gun law expert joins the show for a look at a new bipartisan deal in the U.S. Senate aimed at reducing gun violence after two high-profile mass shootings in New York and Texas. We'll find out what's on the table, the prospects for it to pass. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network.